monumentally important. Work for a flop and you miss this golden moment, perhaps the one chance you'll have in your whole life to get rich. And they'd stuck with Healthian, and now their faith had been rewarded. That is why they sat and waited half the day for Jim Clark to appear on the screen. They waited for an hour, and nothing. Something was holding up Clark's appearance. Pavan tried to discover what. The people at Morgan Stanley in New York had no idea. Finally, Pavan announced that Clark was off on his boat. Of course, Clark had designed the search for the new thing so that it could occur wherever he happened to be. At that moment, he happened to be on his boat, docked in some Caribbean harbor. A camera crew from CNBC waited on the dock, hoping to record Clark's reaction to being the first man to create three different multi-billion-dollar technology companies. They couldn't possibly know that his mind was now fully occupied by the fourth. At any rate, Clark decided he didn't want to go on the television. The CNBC reporter had hinted he might show a map of the Caribbean with the boat on it. Clark didn't like the idea. When Pavan relayed that news, the energy went out of the event. Healthian's engineers trickled reluctantly from the conference room. Pavan and Kittu left together. Kittu was jolly, Pavan sober. As he walked back to his cube, his legs trembled. Kittu put his arm around him, and they shared a laugh. Pavan's cube was no kind of place for a man worth $33 million. It had a computer, a desk, and a giant white board. Pavan went to his whiteboard, stood there for a minute, and quit. There was nothing to draw. The lines, graphs, and charts that he was forever scribbling on the board no longer expressed his meaning. He resembled a man who has swallowed an earthquake whole and was now trying to contain the aftershocks within his frame. He shook involuntarily. He had imagined this moment for nearly 5 years, since he first read in USA Today while sitting in a Delhi hotel about the Netscape IPO. He had met his destiny, and he did not know exactly what to make of it. Pavan Nigam was a rich man. That night I came home and found an email from Stuart Liroff. Stuart had been more reticent about his good fortune than either Pavan or Kittu. When I asked him whether, on balance, the sacrifice had been worth it to his wife, he made a face that suggested it was a close-run thing. "History will document this as the largest financial bubble in the history of the world economy," he said at one point. I think deep down, Stuart did not really expect to make millions of dollars. He was so happy without them. After the IPO, I had asked him if he ever thought about retiring. He said that the thought never crossed his mind, nor should it. Now, he wrote, "My grandfather was a kosher butcher and my father was in the rag trade. I think my reaction to the word retire was almost visceral. But you wouldn't believe what happened to me this evening. As I mentioned, I went with my wife to a local charitable event. There were no less than 500 people there. It was mind-boggling. It seemed like almost everyone came up to me and gushed about how rich I was and about how I could retire and wanted to know what I was going to do now. I felt like I had been bar mitzvahed or just had a baby. You have to understand, I never talked to anyone about my personal finances. In my family, it was always considered bad taste to talk about your finances publicly. And here I was, in the middle of a public event, and it seemed like 250 people knew that I was rich. I felt somehow exposed in public. And you know what? It felt great. A few days after the Healthian IPO, Mike Long was invited onto CNBC to talk about his hot new company, which at $44 a share was now worth $3 billion. There wasn't any question about accepting. CNBC was the cable channel of choice for the speculators who bid up Healthian stock price. There was a room wired on the Stanford campus. It was used by all the TV shows back east. The room was where Silicon Valley executives went when they wanted to talk to their investors. Long drove over to it at 4 a.m. He clipped the microphone to his tie and the earphone to his ear. He looked high up on the wall at the black eye of a single camera. "Look straight into the black eye when you speak," he'd been told. A woman's voice, he'd never actually laid eyes on her, was piped through his earpiece. The lady welcomed Mike Long to CNBC, told him he was on the air, and then asked him a list of questions. A few questions into the list, Long was able to mention our new relationship with IBM. "Let's pick up on that," said the woman at CNBC. "You picking up this company and going forward, How has this acquisition helped you? Long had to think about that one. IBM was worth about $175 billion. It had 235,000 employees, $50 billion a year in revenues, and a long, glorious history. IBM wasn't a company, it was a country. Healthion, well, until a few days before, no one had even heard of Healthion. Now the company was being accused on the official cable channel of the speculating classes of having acquired IBM. Back when Mike Long had been a serious American executive, he had no truck with the wider public. Maybe once or twice his name turned up in the local newspapers when he and his wife attended a United Way dinner. Now he was expected to play a role that was one part commercial celebrity and one part carnival barker. His new role required him to stifle a great deal of bewilderment. He had to find a way to be adaptable enough to keep a straight face when some journalists asked him why he'd bought IBM, but not so adaptable that he lost his self-respect. His central nervous system was busy making the necessary adjustments. One of the many things Mike Long had learned in the transition from serious American executive to keeper of the new thing was to keep the story moving along, or, as he put it, "You have to stay ahead of the public roadmap." The minute investors understood what you were doing, they held you in lower estimation. Solid performance was no longer interesting. Familiarity bred contempt. The dollars invested in Healthion were always threatening to move on to the latest IPO. To woo investors enamored of the new and thus keep your stock price rising, you had to remain in a state of pure possibility. In this question about his acquisition of IBM, Long sensed an opportunity. Healthion buys IBM. That's new. On the television screen, Long's face contorted slightly, in the way it might if a lunatic on the street approached him to say that he had a little green man perched on his shoulder. But before it reached that point, it froze. He smiled. He said that while Healthion had not purchased IBM, it had agreed to provide IBM with technology, thus leaving CNBC viewers with the vague impression that the question was not implausible. Healthion might well have bought IBM, but found it more useful to partner with them. In the month after the IPO, Healthion's stock price behaved like a manic depressive off his medication. First it fell from $44 to $29 a share. Then, on March 8th, the investment bankers, Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs, issued buy recommendations. The next day, the stock shot up 19 points to $48 a share. The enthusiasm, however, was temporary. In early April, it drifted down and then back up some more to $59 a share. From there, it tailed off badly. From the beginning of April to early May, it fell 20 points to $39 a share. Something was holding it back. What that something was soon became clear. Around about this time, Clark heard from a friend, he won't say which one, that Microsoft was taking a new interest in the healthcare industry. The rumor was that Microsoft intended to invest $700 million in a new Atlanta company called WebMD. WebMD wasn't much more than a shell for a brilliant marketing campaign. Its 29-year-old CEO, Jeff Arnold, had persuaded a lot of healthcare organizations that he could make the Internet work for them and persuaded them to sign contracts, but he didn't actually have a product. For that reason, Clark hadn't paid WebMD all that much attention. Microsoft's backing changed his attitude. With Microsoft behind it, there was every chance that WebMD would go public at a higher valuation than Healthion and then establish itself as the leading brand in Internet medicine.
"I couldn't let that happen," said Clark.
In mid-May, Clark and Long flew to Atlanta to meet with Jeff Arnold. When they left the meeting, they had agreed to purchase WebMD, exchanging 1.85 Healthion shares for each WebMD share. Microsoft would own a 17% stake in the combination. It was Clark's original coming to terms with Microsoft. Netscape had taught him the hard way that it was not worth the trouble to resist what he regarded as the evil empire. The Microsoft antitrust trial looked as if it might drag on for several more years. There wasn't even a faint hope that the company would be constrained by the government, at least in time to make a difference to Clark. On balance, Clark decided, it was better to pay protection money. Microsoft's response to Healthion hadn't been as crude as its response to Netscape. "Give us a piece of your company or we'll put you out of business." All the same, its investment in WebMD amounted to a shakedown. "Give us a piece of the action or we'll sponsor some other company to compete with you."
It's grotesquely unfair, Clark said, and I hate it, but there's nothing I can do about it.
On May 20th, the companies announced their merger. The market interpreted the deal as a sign that a new monopoly was being created, and perhaps the market was right. Certainly, the effect of combining Clark World with Microsoft would be to frighten a lot of potential competitors out of the market. Anyone insufficiently frightened could be acquired. Healthian stock ran up nearly 70 points in 2 days to 105. The company was now valued at $16 billion. Out of thin air, it seemed, $16 billion had been plucked. Clark's stake in the enterprise had been whittled down to 6%, worth about $1.3 billion.
It's enough to keep my interest level, he said, a disenchantment I was now familiar with creeping into his voice, but it isn't what I'd like to have.
He also said, when I formed Netscape, I thought about sleeping with the enemy.
Now I know I should have done it. I've gone over to the dark side.
The truth was, it was time for him to move again. On the eve of the new thing, the NetDex, as the brokerage analyst Keith Benjamin described his index of all Internet companies, was worth $405 billion. That was up 654% in the past year. To put that number in perspective, the top 20 media companies, Time Warner, Disney, CBS, etc., had a combined value of $527 billion. Just how much of the NetDex belonged to people associated with Clark's various ventures was hard to say, but in the spring of 1999, I made some quick back-of-the-envelope calculations. They amounted to a rich list of the people in Clark World I'd come to know a bit. The back-of-the-envelope read like this. The CEOs. Mike Long, Healthian, $400 million. Jim Barksdale, Netscape, $1 billion. Tom Jermalak, At Home, $550 million. The VCs, Kleiner Perkins, John Doerr, $1.8 billion. New Enterprise Associates, Dick Kramlich, $700 million. Mayfield Fund, Glenn Mueller, $400 million. The co-founding engineers, Pava Nigam, Healthian, $85 million. Kittu Kalari, Healthian, $30 million. Stuart Leroff, Healthian, $8,500,000. Mark Andreessen, Netscape, $80 million. Tom Davis, Silicon Graphics, $10 million. Rocky Rhodes, Silicon Graphics, $5 million. Kurt Akeley, Silicon Graphics, $5 million. The captain and programmers of Hyperion, Alan Pryor, $1,062,500. Steve Haig, $1 million. Lance Welsh, $1 million. Tim Powell, $1 million. Jim Clark's piece of the NetDex came to $3.2 billion. He was a real after-tax billionaire. He had, as they say, achieved his financial goals. Chapter 18. The New Thing. Different people use different phrases to describe the path Clark's mind took as he wandered along the top of the cliff overlooking the U.S. economy, deciding which rock, if kicked, would wipe out the largest section of the slope below. The venture capitalist John Doerr called it amazing over-the-horizon radar. The Healthian engineer Kittu Kalari called it an animal sense of smell. Hugh Reinhoff, one of the young men the venture capitalists had assigned to follow Clark wherever he went, called it fuzzy logic. His enemies called it bizarre or dysfunctional or, most often, lucky. Each time one of Clark's ventures got rolling, some people, even a few people in Silicon Valley, said he was just lucky. Lucky to have popularized the third dimension in computer space at just the right moment. Lucky to have met Mark Andreessen and seen his internet browser. Lucky to have triggered the internet boom. Lucky to have sought control of healthcare, the world's biggest market, just when it was ready to yield itself up. Luck is one of those unfortunate words that is required to do more than its fair share of the work. What happened to Clark in Silicon Valley was far more interesting than luck. It was the interplay of a character who had a deep feel for technology and a taste for anarchy, with an environment that rewarded both traits. Silicon Valley in the late 1990s was the closest business has ever come to resembling a child's chemistry experiment. Some tiny invisible hand poured one chemical after another into a test tube, in the irresponsible hope of making it go boom. Clark, and people like him, turned out to be the active ingredient. At any rate, in the spring of 1999, after Healthion had established itself as the most successful IPO in a year of fabulously successful IPOs, Clark was a more active ingredient than ever before. There were many reasons for this, but the main one was the Internet. There was no longer much question of what Clark had been saying all along. The Internet was bigger than anyone understood. Pretty much every serious American executive now agreed he had no choice but to adapt or wind up bottled in formaldehyde and displayed on a shelf in the new special exhibit of extinct economic species. In March 1999, Jack Welch, the chairman of General Electric, one of those people who created conventional business wisdom every time he opened his mouth, had said that the Internet was the single most important event in the U.S. economy since the Industrial Revolution. Even the normally understated chairman of the U.S. Federal Reserve, Alan Greenspan, had said that the revolution in information technology has altered the structure of the way the American economy works. Growth was change, and change was disturbing. And if you doubted it, you needed only to ask any serious American executive. The business magazines even had a phrase for the pangs of incipient doom that afflicted them: Internet anxiety. Internet anxiety was simply the sense, now widely shared, that you were about to be put out of business by someone who operated in the spirit of Jim Clark. The Internet created many opportunities for people like Clark, outsiders, troublemakers, to think thoughts that would turn entire industries on their heads. Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon.com, had upended the book business. The founders of eBay had upended the auction business. The founders of E-Trade and Ameritrade had upended the Wall Street stock brokerage firms. In 1998, the manager of Merrill Lynch's 15,000 stockbrokers, John Steffens, had called the Internet trading firms a serious threat to America's financial lives and assured his employees that Merrill Lynch would never do such a thing. The next year, Merrill Lynch created an Internet trading department. Paul Romer, the young economist whose work on new growth theory had stressed the importance of technology and economic growth, and by implication conferred a magnificent importance on the new thing, hinted at another deeper reason technological change was so unsettling. In a digression from his otherwise rigorous analysis, Romer wrote that, "Once we admit that there is room for newness, that there are vastly more conceivable possibilities than realized outcomes, we must confront the fact that there is no special logic behind the world we inhabit, no particular justification for why things are the way they are. Any number of arbitrarily small perturbations along the way could have made the world as we know it turn out differently. We are forced to admit that the world as we know it is the result of a long string of chance outcomes." Journal of Developmental Economics, Volume 43, 1994. Clark, the inventor of chance outcomes, was himself a kind of chance outcome. Not long after I'd met him, back when Netscape stock was speeding to zero and Healthion stock was considered worthless, he'd announced his plan to retire once he became a real after-tax billionaire. He intended to float around the world on his new boat once it was finished. Even then, you could see he couldn't possibly believe what he was saying. His life was an adventure story. Without suspense, it lost its purpose. Besides, he was still curious to find out what happened next. How would he know unless he set out to make it happen? The near certainty that something important was about to bubble up out of him, the sense that he had some peculiar gift for letting the right thing bubble up, had him and a lot of other people in Silicon Valley on the edge of their seats. By April of 1999, people outside of the Valley wanted to talk to Clark about Healthion, which now seemed poised to turn the U.S. healthcare industry on its head. Clark's interest in Healthion was draining out of him. He wasn't even sure he wanted to keep his investment in Healthion. Healthion was the past. The time had come for the new thing. In the spring of 1999, Clark started thinking seriously about his money. Actually, he was always thinking seriously about his money, and so I should have seen what was coming next, but I'd been distracted by all the talk about turning Hyperion software into the home of the future. He'd even gone and paid $12 million for a 35-bedroom, 32,000-square-foot mansion in Palm Beach, mainly, it seemed, so that he'd have a place to test his software. Il Palmetto, the mansion was called. It had been built by Joseph Widener back in the 1930s, when rich people were meant to be idle. If he could reduce a 32,000-square-foot home to the sum of its digital data and administer that data over the Internet, Clark figured, he could do the same thing with any home. Clark had bought Il Palmetto after Steve Haig, the boat's programmer, had explained to him, in an email, how the software that controls the boat can become a dot-com company. The new company was to be called Landscape. Landscape and Il Palmetto turned out to be just another false lead. At some point, probably as we crossed the ocean, Clark had lost interest in the home of the future. The home of the future would have to wait. He decided first to change as much as he could of what he disliked about being really rich. He'd accumulated a long list of grievances from his brief experience with real wealth. He disliked paying taxes so much that he had moved his official residence to Palm Beach, Florida. He disliked the hassle of paying bills so much that he'd hired a fellow named Harvey to take care of it. He disliked stockbrokers so much that he ignored their advice to diversify and kept all his wealth in Netscape and Healthian. He disliked venture capitalists and investment bankers and, in general, the phalanx of financial intermediaries who sat between the creators of wealth and their just deserts. At first he decided that what he really wanted was what rich people have always had, a family office. The rich man's family office is normally a staff of people who do nothing but take care of the rich man's money. Money butlers. Pretty quickly, however, he realized he wanted more than a money butler. He wanted to be able to watch what his money butlers did. He wanted to be able to take in every aspect of his money at a glance, no matter where on earth he happened to be, and at what time. The Internet was perfectly suited to what he had in mind. The more Clark thought about it, the more he thought that the best money butler would use the Internet. The Internet would spare him endless headaches, no more phone calls to banks or accountants. No more looking around for a pocket calculator to figure out how much he was worth. No more digging for receipts to find out how much he'd paid for the Picasso. Before he knew it, he had an idea for a business. He called his new company My CFO. His thinking ran something like this. There were a lot of people just like him who'd made millions of dollars and were now coping with the hassle of handling it. Clark had read somewhere that there were now 180,000 American decamillionaires, people with at least $10 million in assets. Together, they controlled something like $15 trillion in assets. The wealthy masses, Clark called them. Clark figured that the wealthy masses were just waiting to be organized into a fighting unit. They had nothing to lose but their gold chains. Certainly, they shared some basic financial objectives. They wanted to minimize taxes and hassles. They wanted to maximize wealth. My CFO would help rich people achieve their objectives. It would be, in the first place, a home for money. The idea is that everything to do with their finances goes through this one place, Clark said. Once he'd persuaded the wealthy masses to collect their wealth in this one place, he could negotiate on behalf of that wealth, almost as if it belonged to one person. Say you had $2 trillion under one roof, Clark explained, or even a trillion. The power of that money is huge. You could go and cut deals with banks or brokerage firms or insurance companies or anyone else who wanted to do business with the money. The rich people in My CFO would wind up with a long list of special deals. What he was groping towards wasn't just a new company, it was a new kind of financial institution, and as murky as it was in its conception, it posed a fantastic threat to old, established financial institutions. The Internet had made it possible for people to organize themselves in new ways. It made it possible for rich people to organize themselves. No one said that the new organization of rich people had to behave like other financial organizations. The people who joined forces in My CFO would have great bargaining power with traditional financial institutions. They wouldn't be constrained in the way that, say, the people who had deposited $1.5 trillion in Merrill Lynch accounts were constrained. When a Merrill Lynch customer wanted to buy stocks, he had to call a Merrill Lynch broker. Jim Clark's pile of money, which he figured could easily be the world's biggest pile of money, would operate independently, anarchically. Its customers as a group could play Silicon Valley venture capitalists and Wall Street investment bankers and Main Street stockbrokers and Swiss private bankers off against each other, much the way Clark already did in his own private business life. If My CFO did not seize control of the levers of capitalism, it could at least remove the levers from the capitalists' hands. And the bigger the pile of money inside my CFO, the more market clout this cartel of the very rich would have. Once the number of dollars became sufficiently huge, they could sit on top of the financial world like an operating system sat on top of a personal computer. As usual, Clark felt he had to move quickly. This time, he didn't even have a drawing on a piece of paper, just a vague idea in his head. He wanted my CFO to be a multi-billion dollar public company within a year, so that it might be better positioned to gobble up the inevitable competition. He thought its market value should exceed Healthion's, which now exceeded $15 billion. In late April, he visited a few Silicon Valley opinion leaders, whose commercial success gave them a great deal of influence with the wealthy masses. John Chambers, the CEO of Cisco, the maker of hardware for the Internet, was himself a billionaire. He was also an engineer. He also had long admired Clark's ability to change with the times. The valley was filled with people who had created a couple of successful companies of the same type. Clark alone moved from one ruling concept to the next. After he'd heard Clark out, Chambers had said,
"You control 80% of the wealth, and everything else follows. This thing has the potential to change financial services forever."
Saying that,
"This could be a breakaway situation,"
he asked to buy a 5% stake in my CFO and said he intended to be the company's first customer. Tom Jermalak, the CEO of At Home, had the same reaction.
"Jim's changed the deals people get from venture capitalists," TJ said. "There's no reason he can't take it a step further."
TJ also bought 5% of my CFO. In the Valley equivalent of noblesse oblige, Clark offered smaller stakes in my CFO to the captains who had served him well, Jim Barksdale and Mike Long. Long bought 2.5% of the company. Barksdale called and asked to see the business plan.
"I don't have a business plan," Clark said.
Barksdale, too, said he wanted a stake. In early June, Clark drove up Sand Hill Road to Benchmark Capital, the venture capitalists who'd just made a name for themselves by backing eBay. A few more glamorous deals like that, and Benchmark could offer the same sort of imprimatur as Kleiner Perkins, which was perhaps the biggest reason that people like Clark sought Kleiner Perkins's money. The Kleiner Halo, as it was called. The trouble with the Kleiner Halo is that it was as up for grabs as everything else in the valley. Out of fear of losing yet another very public success to Benchmark, Kleiner Perkins had just paid $25 million for a 33% stake in a new company called Google.com. Google.com consisted of a pair of Stanford graduate students who had a piece of software that might or might not make it easier to search the Internet. In short, Kleiner Perkins was already feeling a bit of the pressure on capitalists that Clark, with my CFO, wanted to create a lot more of. He did not seriously think he'd allow Benchmark to invest in his new company. He hoped only that word of his trip to Benchmark would reach John Doerr at Kleiner Perkins. A week or so after he visited Benchmark Capital, Clark drove back up Sand Hill Road to Kleiner Perkins. John Doerr had gathered his partners in the conference room. Outside of Jim Clark's soul, the Kleiner conference room was the closest thing to ground zero of the Internet boom. Sitting in their conference room, Kleiner partners had backed a half-dozen of the most sensational new enterprises. Netscape, Amazon.com, Excite, At Home, Healthion. The firm claimed, plausibly, to have funded companies worth more than $500 billion. The conference room seemed an unlikely place to create such a pile. The walls were made of glass, the wood was a light bird's-eye maple, and the sunlight streamed in from every direction. You could scour the room for weeks, and unless you could enter the minds of the men inside the place, you would never find a shadow. The space in which the most important financial decisions of the 1990s had been made was as light and airy as a ski lodge. The iconology of financial power had changed. Clark took his seat in the sun and explained all about the wealthy masses and his plans to organize them into a fighting unit. One of the Kleiner partners asked about his business model. Business model is one of those terms of art that was central to the Internet boom. It glorified all manner of half-baked plans. All it really meant was how you planned to make money. The business model for Microsoft, for instance, was to sell software for $120 a pop that cost 50 cents to manufacture. The business model for Healthion was to add a few pennies to every bill or order or request that emanated from a doctor's office. The business model for Netscape was a work in progress. No one ever did really figure out how to make money from Netscape. In its brief life, Netscape had lost money. The business model of most internet companies was to attract huge crowds of people to a website and then sell others the chance to advertise products to the crowds. It was still not clear that the model made sense. The business model for my CFO, such as it was curiously old-fashioned. Indeed, it was a departure from the now common approach to creating a business on the Internet. Rather than maximizing the number of people who viewed his website, Clark would set out to maximize the number of dollars. My CFO would charge the wealthy masses, on average, $50,000 a year each to use the service. They'd pay it because the service would save them at least as much again. Clark figured he might ultimately attract 100,000 wealthy customers. Right there you had $5 billion a year in revenues. He put it another way. An accountant with an established practice who demanded a salary of about $200,000 a year brought in nearly $2 million a year in revenues. Within a year, Clark figured, he'd have hired 400 accountants, mainly from the big accounting firms, who already advised rich people. In exchange for leaving their stable jobs with their big companies, the accountants would receive stock options. They'd come because, like everyone else in America, they were frantically eager to participate in the Internet boom.
"How often do accountants have the chance to get rich?" Clark asked the Kleiner partners rhetorically.
It was a business model even a Graham and Dodd investor could love, which meant it was relatively immune to stock market reversals. It would have profits, lots of them. With companies called Google going for $75 million, Clark did not see much point in selling air. Everyone else was already doing that. The revolution had consumed the revolutionary. The revolutionary responded by setting out to consume the revolution.
"Old Internet thinking," is how he dismissed the hundreds of companies modeled on Netscape.
He then went on to explain what did not need explaining to partners at Kleiner Perkins, the power of $1 trillion or so pooled into a kind of cartel. There was no end to what might be done with it once it was collected. He concluded by saying what the Kleiner partners had already figured out, that he had
a much, much better idea how I'm going to make money than I did when I sat here 5 years ago and told you about Netscape. He called it one of the biggest opportunities I've ever seen.
When Clark finished, John Doerr took over the meeting. Doerr was wonderful in the literal sense of the word. He was full of wonder. In Silicon Valley, as in every highly strung status culture, there was a tendency for people to know it all. Doerr retained an almost childlike capacity for curiosity and awe. His feelings for Clark were a case in point. Even in the dark periods of their relationship, he spoke of Clark behind his back as a national treasure. That's what he told his fellow Kleiner partners, who sometimes wondered why Doerr took so much trouble to keep Clark sweet. Jim Clark was a national treasure. He understood exactly how deep and mysterious was this force seated on the other side of the Kleiner Perkins conference room table. Normally, Kleiner partners deliberated for a few days before deciding whether to invest in a new company. They didn't do that with Netscape, Doerr now reminded Clark. He'd called Clark an hour and a half after he had explained that particular new thing and agreed to the most onerous terms ever demanded from venture capitalists. The terms were even more onerous this time, but Doerr wanted to move even faster. He turned to Clark and said,
"Would you like us to have a show of hands right now?"
Clark said that wasn't necessary. In any case, the decision was a formality. An hour and a half later, Doerr called him and said that Kleiner wanted to buy as much of my CFO as Clark was willing to sell, and he would like to sit on its board of directors. For the next few weeks, Clark went back and forth on how much Kleiner should be permitted to invest or whether they should be permitted to invest at all.
"I don't need 'em," he said one day.
The next day he said,
"If I don't let 'em invest, they'll start a competitor."
Finally, he decided to let Doerr buy a 12% stake in my CFO. At the same time, he leaked word of the new venture to the press. He'd once told me that he didn't understand why business journalists thought that businessmen would tell them the truth about their affairs. A good businessman was obliged to manipulate public opinion, especially now that public opinion was so important to the future of the business. In the summer of 1999, he demonstrated the point. He presented to reporters a distorted, slimmed-down version of his ambition. The idea was to get the word out to the accountants he wanted to hire and to create a buzz about the company without alerting the competition. Once again, he was fairly clear in his mind who the competition was.
"I want to avoid waving a red flag to Microsoft," he explained to me. "So instead of the wealthy masses, I've been saying high-net-worth individuals. And instead of laying out the whole idea, I just say we'll be doing tax planning."
Sure enough, not long after Clark leaked his new story to the press, the accountants began to call. In just a few weeks, several hundred people Clark had never heard of came looking to be a part of the new enterprise. The sheer volume of the calls suggested that the accountants at the big accounting firms were spreading the word amongst themselves. Like everyone else, they'd become attuned to the frequency of the new thing. A financial advisor at the accounting firm of Coopers and Lybrand, Price Waterhouse, for instance, called Harvey, whom Clark had installed temporarily as CEO of My CFO, and asked if what he'd read in some business publication was accurate. Harvey said it was.
"You guys will control all the financial data," said the accountant. "And if you control the data, you can control everything else. Can I come work for you?"
The accountant was making $500,000 a year, and he was calling to inquire about a job with a startup. In his voice, Clark was able to detect the creaking sound of the American professional class capitulating to a new order. One evening, as we sat in his kitchen, I reminded Clark that he had said that once he became a real after-tax billionaire, he'd retire. He said, without missing a beat,
"I just want to make more money than Larry Ellison. Then I'll stop."
This was news. I pointed out that he'd never before mentioned this ambition.
"I just want to have more money than Larry Ellison," he said again. "I don't know why, but once I have more money than Larry Ellison, I'll be satisfied."
Larry Ellison, the CEO of Oracle, the biggest software company in the valley, was worth about $9 billion. Clark was worth a bit more than $3 billion. On the other hand, Ellison's wealth was completely tied up in Oracle stock, which had mostly missed out on the boom. At the rate Clark's wealth was growing, he'd pass Ellison within 6 months. I pointed this out and asked the obvious question. "What happens after you have more than Larry Ellison? Would you want to have more money than, say, Bill Gates?"
"Oh, no," Clark said, waving my question to the side of the room where the ridiculous ideas gathered to commiserate with each other. "That'll never happen."
A few minutes later, after the conversation had turned to other matters, he came clean.
"You know," he said, "just for one moment, I would kind of like to have the most. Just for one tiny moment."
It was one of those tiny moments when it was good to have a record of our conversations. Just a few months before, when he was worth a mere $600 million, Clark had said,
"I just want to have $1 billion after taxes. Then I'll be satisfied."
Back further, before he started Netscape, he told Mark Grossman, one of the young engineers who had helped him to create Silicon Graphics, something similar. Grossman had recalled,
"Jim came into my office just before he left to start Netscape and said, 'SGI is okay, but I'd really like to have $100 million.
Back even further, before he'd started Silicon Graphics, he told Tom Davis
that what he really wanted was to have $10 million.
The numbers, they kept moving, and yet he was earnest about them. What Clark meant when he said, "I'd really like to have," was, "I will do what I need to do to get." It was not exactly wishful thinking. A world in which Larry Ellison had more money than he did was suddenly unacceptable. Why does someone perpetually create for themselves the condition for their own dissatisfaction? Listening to Clark talk about how much money he needed to make was like watching the racing dog who had the wit to grab hold of the remote device that controls the mechanical rabbit. Rather than slow it down, however, he speeds it up. Clark played these little tricks on himself so that he would have an excuse, however flimsy, to keep running as fast as he could. It was the same way with his resentments. He treated those who had done him wrong in much the same way he treated those he did not like who had more money than he did. They were all motives. Plainview, the Navy, Glenn Mueller, Ed McCracken, various venture capitalists. He needed someone or some place to doubt him so that he could prove them wrong. Obviously, Clark couldn't stop using technology to change the world, and so he needed an excuse not to stop. The reasons he couldn't stop were ultimately unknowable, but I assume that the best and most lasting motive for wanting to change the way things are is to be unhappy with the way things are.
People who are unhappy with the way things are tend to remain unhappy even after they have changed them. The nature of their unhappiness is such that change does not slake it. The difference with Clark is that he continued to believe in the endless possibilities of change, even after he'd experienced its limitations. He was the least happy optimist there ever was. No matter how well Jim Clark did for himself, it was always 2 in the morning in his heart, and he was lying awake. Above all, one thing was clear. His pursuit of the new thing depended on his curious amnesia. His ability to forget what he said he would next do, or what he'd thought would make him happy, was the mortar on which he laid his endless tears of self-renewal. He'd made a kind of religion of keeping only those parts of his past he needed for fuel, on his journey into the future. His escape from the past was necessarily incomplete. The drug hasn't been invented that permits people to forget as perfectly as they would sometimes like to forget. He still had his tuba, for instance. The tarnished old instrument sat mysteriously in the corner of the guest room upstairs, the one that stored the cardboard boxes filled with the scraps of paper his former secretary had rescued from Clark's past. It was such an odd thing to stumble across in a house that otherwise said so little about who its inhabitant was, or where he was from, that I had asked him about it. He'd played the tuba as a child, he'd said. 20 years before, just after he'd founded Silicon Graphics and made his first millions, he'd been seized by the desire to play again. And so he'd bought this tuba. He soon found he'd lost interest in it. Only the idea of playing his tuba pleased him now. So he'd propped it in the corner of the guest bedroom and left it there, as a lone reminder of something he couldn't quite explain. Chapter 19. The Past Outside the Box. A large aquifer beneath the flatlands between Amarillo and Lubbock supplies Plainview with more water than any other town in West Texas. The water was discovered not long after the Civil War. By the end of the 19th century, Plainview tilled the most fertile cotton farming land in the United States. The local economy was premised on the family farm, a premise called into doubt in Clark's boyhood, when the modern high-tech farm moved in. Since then, all news for Plainview has been bad news. Such is the economic history of Plainview, Texas. I drove into the town one bright winter morning. Poor places are slower to change than rich places. Perhaps poor people are slower to change than rich people, too. The neat brick school, the tiny house, the church, the people who, as Clark had once said, "watch the outside world as if it was a television program," were pretty much as he must have left them back in the early 1960s. The sound at the center of town was the sound of the inside of a conch shell. The wind howled. The irredeemably beige buildings perched low across the flat yellow grass as if designed to diminish the human imagination. The skyline was unmarked either by windbreaks or ambition. The lone exception was the water tower on the edge of town. Plainview was built on water, and the tower that held that water was painted proudly. Only it didn't say Plainview, it said Rustwater. 10 years ago, Paramount Pictures used Plainview as a movie set for a comedy called Leap of Faith, about a prairie evangelist, played by Steve Martin. The Hollywood people came for a few weeks, got everyone worked up, and left behind more money than the town had seen in a long time. In the bargain, they repainted the Plainview water tower with the name of the fictional town in the movie. Plainview never bothered to repaint it. Other than that, Plainview seemed to have settled on an old idea of itself. It was staying pat, declining the dealer's offer of another card. It had become one of those places defined by what it does not have, rather than what it does, and by who has left, rather than who has stayed. The man whose departure defined the town with the most dreadful clarity was Jim Clark. On that bright winter day, I followed the directions Clark's mother, Hazel McClure, had given me to her brick house, slightly bigger than the houses on either side of it. Waiting inside were Clark's younger sister Sue and her husband Roger. I had come to ask them some questions, but it turned out that Hazel had a question for me.
"Do you know when Jim will come and visit next?"
she asked, after we'd settled into our chairs. On the rare occasions Clark visits Plainview, Texas, he lands at the airfield on the outskirts of town, has lunch with his mother, and then flies off to someplace else as quickly as he can.
He seldom drives into the town and never visits home. He's never seen the house his mother bought with the stock options he gave her in Silicon Graphics. The few stops he's made have all been unscheduled. The flight path from Palm Beach to San Jose just happens to pass directly over Plainview, Texas, and every so often Clark drops out of the sky. Almost always, he takes his mother by surprise. For instance, Hazel learned of Clark's most recent visit a year ago from her answering machine. She found a message on it from Jim saying he was right over her head in descent and intended to remain in Plainview just long enough to refuel. If she was around, he said, they could have lunch out at the airfield.
"I just turned around and ran out the door to the airport," recalls Hazel.
Half the town followed her. The appearance of Clark's jet in the Plainview sky was a public event. All of Plainview's residents knew the plane by sight, and 100 or so of them rushed out to the airfield just to watch it land.
"They just know that anything the size of Jim's plane just got to be Jim,"
said Roger, Clark's brother-in-law.
"Because there is nothing else like that. And truth is, whenever he comes, Jim kind of buzzes the town."
Hazel now said that most of what she knew about her son's illustrious career she knew from having read it in magazines. She had difficulty squaring the boy she raised with the man she read about. She has no advanced theory why Clark became who he became. All she has is a few memories which might or might not offer clues to a person on a search for a character. She remembers him as a 4-year-old, when she first suspected he might be smarter than the average little boy. He'd recite back entire nursery rhymes from memory, and boast that anything you tell me I can remember as long as I pay attention. A bit later, when he was 12, she recalls him accidentally shooting a hole through every toe on his left foot with a .22-caliber rifle. He lay in bed with his foot in a cast and built more model airplanes than she ever saw anyone build. She also remembers later that year, just before Christmas, finding a sack of light bulbs tucked away in a closet. Hazel couldn't afford Christmas lights, yet here were hundreds of bulbs in a sack waiting to be strung. It turned out that Jim had stolen them off other people's houses. The telephone rang. Clark's sister Sue rose to answer it. In a clipped tone of poorly suppressed irritation, she said,
"Sorry, we're not investing right now."
Pause. Then more tensely,
"I said we're not investing."
She hung up. Returning, she explained that the shares in Netscape Clark had given them had made them rich.
"And you have to understand," she said, "that when this happened, we were poor. I was ready to cook the cat."
I assumed this was a joke and laughed. I assumed wrong. She was, in fact, ready to cook the cat. The Netscape IPO had saved at least one life. The deprivation, Sue recalled, occurred only 4 years ago. Now all of Plainview thought of her and her family as these walking sacks of cash. People treated them differently. They asked for loans. They asked for stock tips. They asked what kind of company Jim might start next. They asked if they could invest in it. There was now a Clark-sized moat filled with money that separated his family from the rest of Plainview. Hazel resumed the mining of her memory, and she had a lot of material to mine. The most chilling of it concerned Clark's father, who apparently drank all day and beat on Hazel all night. Hazel put up with the routine for years. It became, in a way, normal. She hoped only that Charles, Clark's father, would hit her someplace where people at work couldn't see the bruises. Charles became more and more brutal, however, and Hazel divorced him when Jim was 14. Charles moved out onto the streets of Plainview. From there, he terrorized his family with an ingenuity he showed in no other aspect of his life. One episode still stood out brightly in Hazel's mind. She glanced out the window of her office one day and spotted Charles standing in front of her car. He'd raised the hood and was tinkering with the engine. She ran down and hollered. Charles ran off. After that, she parked in front of a car repair shop and asked the owner to keep an eye on it for her. One evening after work, she found a man from the auto shop waiting for her. He told her he'd just seen a man resembling her ex-husband working on her transmission. Hazel opened the transmission and discovered steel shavings. The man from the auto shop helped her to clean them out. Thinking they'd fix the problem, Hazel set out with her baby daughter, Sue, to visit friends in Amarillo. On the road, the car broke down. Whoever had put the steel shavings in the engine had also put sand in the oil. Fixing the engine cost Hazel 2 months' pay. That night, she told her son what had happened. Clark had just turned 16.
"Jim got up and left the house," said Hazel, "and went to find his father. When he came back, he was crying." "I never found out what happened," said Sue, who was clearly feeling left out. "I never knew what happened," said Hazel. "But I tell you what," said Sue, "after that, my father never bothered my mother again."
It turned out that Hazel also remembered the tuba. How could she forget it? The tarnished brass instrument propped in the corner of Clark's guest bedroom had struck me as doubly odd, and I now said as much. It was the only artifact of his past that he thought worthy of display. It was also, for someone as willful and individualistic as Clark, a poor choice of instrument. The job of the tuba player is to blend with the orchestra. No one who wanted to stand out from the crowd would choose it for himself. The tuba had come as a surprise to Hazel.
"One day Jim came home from school with it," she said, "and he could play a little. He used to go into the bathroom where he could hear himself better and sit on the commode, with the seat down, you know, and practice. I never knew where he got the tuba from. I guess the school gave it to him. I could never have afforded to buy any instrument."
Hazel supported a family of four on the $225 a month she took home from the hospital, where she worked as a doctor's assistant. After she had paid the bills, she had $5 a month to spend on groceries. Clark was obviously well aware of their situation from a very young age. He had chosen to play the tuba because the tuba was the one instrument supplied to the pupil by the school free of charge. Hazel never knew that, but it was true. Clark's old band director, O.T. Ryan, said as much. At the Plainview Middle School, the students who wished to play flutes, clarinets, trumpets, and trombones were required to buy their own instruments. The tuba players alone received a loaner from the school. Not long after he'd come home in tears from what turned out to be his final meeting with his father, Clark quit playing his tuba. Soon after that, he was expelled from school and left town. Once he left, he became a stranger to his family. He'd turn up every now and again, and the family now recalled something about each visit. One time, not long after he'd left, for instance, he came home talking about nothing but computers.
"No one in Plainview had seen a computer except in the movies," said Hazel.
Another time he came home with financial ambition.
"When Jim came home from the Navy," Hazel recalled, "he told his uncle that someday he was going to make $50,000 a year."
Sue hooted and clapped.
"He done a bit better than that,"
Hazel continues. "I remember him telling me when he came back from the Navy, 'Mama, I'm going to show Plainview.'" That handy phrase, the American dream, is a good excuse not to think about what happens when someone rockets from the bottom of a society to the top. Or, for that matter, why they do it. The ordinary human mind is not well equipped to handle the more extreme forms of social mobility. Once, Clark told me that what he'd left behind in Plainview was beyond belief different from the life he had made for himself. When I asked him why he never talked about it, he said,
"I used to think it would be interesting to kids who grew up in shit and were trying to figure out how to get out. Now it bores even me."
A couple of times, however, some piece of his past popped out of him unbidden. One of these times came when he was out learning to fly his helicopter. We dropped down for lunch at an airfield on the fringes of Silicon Valley. Munching on our sandwiches beside a golf course, Clark asked John, the cop he'd hired to watch him teach himself to fly, if he ever had to shoot anybody in the line of duty. John told the following story. He'd answered a call in downtown San Jose and found a guy out on the street wired to the gills. The guy reached into his windbreaker, whipped out a small pistol, and fired. The bullet passed between John's body and his arm. John drew his own gun and fired back. The guy fell, obviously hit, his legs splayed wide. John fired again and shot off the guy's left testicle.
"I gave him a vasectomy," said John.
He arrived at the end of the story, but did not know how to end it. He became self-conscious. That's the trouble with adventure stories. They usually don't lead you anywhere you actually need to go. The endless thrills and chills all turn out to have been a substitute for meaning. They have so many beginnings and so many ends that they have no real beginning and no real end. The cop must have sensed this because after his joke about the vasectomy, he quickly added,
Shooting people's not the worst part of being a cop.
The worst part, he said, was entering a house in which a wife had just been beaten by her husband. It used to be that the law prevented the police from doing anything to stop the beatings unless the wife wanted to press charges. Now, at least, John could haul the husband down to central lockup. Something in that statement triggered Clark's memory, and those peculiarly rusty synapses in his brain fired themselves up. He had a story to tell, a story from his past.
"My father used to beat the hell out of my mother," he began. "When I was a kid feeling my oats, you know, 15 or 16, my father and my mother had split, and my mother was dating another guy."
The cop just nodded and kept eating his sandwich, which, oddly, seemed a perfectly natural response. Clark had said what he'd said with the near indifference of a man talking about the weather, and yet it was as sad as the sigh of a lion. He continued,
"My mother, one day someone put sugar in a gas tank. We didn't know who did it, but we always suspected it was my father. Anyway, one night there's a ruckus outside, and my mother goes to the door and sees someone fiddling with the gas cap on the car. He gets away before anyone can see who he is, so I had been drinking, and I was feeling my oats. I got into the car and raced over to this bar where my father always hung out, and I got there before he did. He showed up a few minutes later. I just walked up to him and punched him. I broke his nose. He was laying in the dirt bleeding. I told him, 'Don't you ever come over to our house again. If you ever come over, I'll kill you.' And he just got up and said, 'Why did you do that? Why did you hit me?'"
With that, Clark ended his own adventure story conclusively.
"I went home and I cried for 2 hours, because I thought maybe that he hadn't done it and that I had hit him without cause."
The way he told the anecdote, clearly a version of the story Hazel had told, warped by memory, was at least as surprising as the story itself. It was not evidence from the past offered up by a person who wished to be seen as a victim, nor was it a tale of youthful bravado. The violence inside Clark did not manifest itself physically as machismo. From the start, his tone had not wavered. It was the tone of a man who long ago had figured out that the past was the one thing he couldn't change. The past was the one little mechanical problem he couldn't fix. We tossed our paper plates into the trash, climbed back into the helicopter, and strapped ourselves in for another terrifying ride. Clark seized the controls and took us up. Up, 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 up we rose until the world from a very great height once again felt new. Epilogue. The sun shone brightly on the clear, untroubled sea. When Alan Pryor maneuvered Hyperion into the narrow channel leading to the shallow harbor on the north coast of Antigua, he probably knew that he would be fired. Not long after the boat reached the dock, Clark would tell Alan to shove off. Clark had no one reason for firing the captain. Alan just wasn't well suited to managing the crew of a computerized sailboat. By the time 6 months later that Hyperion sailed beneath the Golden Gate Bridge and into the San Francisco Bay, Jamie, too, would be gone. Hyperion's captain and half of its crew would be new. But for that one final moment, Alan Pryor was still Jim Clark's captain. He guided Hyperion skillfully towards the shore without so much as a glance at the computer screen beneath the wheel. The computer offered up all sorts of useful information: the depth of the sea, the speed of the ship, the subtle shifts in the wind's strength and direction. Alan snorted and said,
"I never look at the computer. I don't trust it."
Then returned to the business of guiding the boat towards the shore. Slowly he turned into the harbor, and when he did, Simon, standing on the bow, gave a whoop. Behind a stand of dismasted sailboats was the boat Simon was working on when Clark stole him away to learn all about computers, Juliet. By then, the crew knew that Juliet was the reason Hyperion existed, that after he had boarded Juliet in the San Francisco Bay, Clark had decided he wanted one like it, only bigger and smarter. Juliet had led to Hyperion, and Hyperion had led to Netscape's IPO, and Netscape's IPO had triggered the Internet boom. Of course, the boom probably would have happened without Juliet, or for that matter, without Netscape. But I doubt it would have happened quite the same way. Clark's first sighting of Juliet was one of those small perturbations that radically altered the world we inhabit. Now Juliet felt small and insignificant. The crew of Hyperion waved to her crew in the same spirit that the winner of a beauty pageant hugs the runner-up. Clark waved, too. Once he had the biggest mast and the finest boat, he didn't care to rub it in. He was a good winner. Poor losers often are. The joy of winning was only slightly diminished by the sighting of Larry Ellison's much bigger powerboat. This was a curiously small world. We docked right beside it, and then left quickly for Clark's plane. But before we did, I went down to Clark's cabin. I wanted to hear whatever he'd concluded about the crossing, and whether he thought there was a business in the boat software. I found him hovering over an architectural drawing. It was neatly spread out on his desk, beside his computer. It looked very much like a drawing of a boat, I said, coming up behind him. It is a boat, he said. He'd asked the man who had designed Hyperion to draw the lines for a sailboat half again as big as Hyperion, or a bit longer than 250 feet. He'd already spoken to Walter Hausman about it, and Walter was willing to build it, even if it meant building a new building that could hold it. The drawing was what Clark thought of as his new boat. I suppose he must have seen me flinch, because pretty quickly he was explaining why he needed to be thinking about building another boat. He'd spent the last 5 years and upended the U.S. economy to get his hands on the one we'd just sailed across the Atlantic Ocean. "Hyperion is a beautiful boat," he said, and I knew when he said it what the next word would be. "But..." His finger traced the lines of his new boat, which was still no more than a figment of his imagination. Pure possibility. A smile lengthened across his face. Hyperion was nice, but this was the perfect boat.
We hope that you have enjoyed our presentation of The New Thing by Michael Lewis. Copyright 2000 by Michael Lewis. Read by Bruce Risen. Directed by Laura Grafton. Engineered by Jill Sovis. Performance copyright 1999 by Brilliance Audio. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, Post Office Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.